find the answers to questions you may or may not have asked yourself here at Kaleidoscience, Conversations on Cognitive Science. This episode is hosted by Elisa Palmer and Sophie Kühner. One question of equality is what fairness and justice really mean in our daily lives. And feminism kind of grew out of this push, starting with struggles like the right to vote and later expanding to a broader challenge to systems that generally hold people back and value certain people or certain groups over others. Currently, this topic to me feels like it's getting more and more relevant once again, especially with the current political times we're in. And this is why I'm super excited to have today's guest here, which is Carol Hay. She's a professor and department chair at the Department of Philosophy at the University of Massachusetts in the US. And yeah, I'm really happy to have you here. So super excited to our conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we usually do a little get-to-know game with our guests. So I will read some beginnings of sentences and you are meant to finish them just with whatever comes to mind first.
So let's do it.
As a kid, I always wanted to be.
As a kid, I always wanted to be. To be honest, I don't think I had the content there. I knew I wanted to run away. I grew up in a very small town in rural Canada. No one in my family had ever been to university. It was a town of about 800 people in the middle of the prairies. There were no paved roads. There were no stoplights. And I didn't fit in so well. I was a bit of a square peg. And so I didn't really have enough exposure to the world to know fully what I could be, but I knew I wanted to be something out there. So that's maybe how I go with that.
Okay. I also come from an 800 people village without any traffic lights somewhere in rural Germany. So
there you go.
I can Same. Relate.
Same.
It's oh wow.
If I was an emoji, I would be.
Oh, this is one's easy. You know the one with the kind of like narrowed eyes and the mouth that's kind of crooked, like that one. That is definitely my spirit emoji.
So these some yeah
sort of the skeptical yeah
that's also slightly looking sideways, right?
Yeah. Yes, I am skeptical emoji.
My favorite thing to do on a day off is
I think it's probably a toss-up between working on jigsaw puzzles. I have this nerdy obsession with jigsaw puzzles. I find it's the only thing that sort of quiets my mind. And with the current political climate, especially here in the US, I'm finding myself really just obsessed with jigsaw puzzles. And then at the other end of the spectrum, I really enjoy dancing and raving. And I actually come to Germany and Berlin quite often, several times a year, just to take part in your excellent culture in that regard. So yes, that's sort of the opposite of jigsaw puzzles, but I guess I contain multitudes.
Very much, but both very fun.
Yes.
Right now, I'm most fascinated by?
Right now, I'm most fascinated by thinking very hard about how to form community and communities of resistance in the face of some pretty significant political horrors that I think we are collectively facing down. So I'm trying to learn more about historical successes and failures in this regard. And I'm really sort of trying to maintain and foster relationships with people in my community and extended community of activists, queers, feminists, these sorts of folks, and really just sort of figuring out how do we take care of each other in this new world order.
Yeah. I understand. I know it's time to call it a day when.
Oh, I know it's time to call it a day when I get hangry, right? So sort of hangry, anxious, right? When it's time for a snack, I really just need to sort of stop and get something to eat.
I think that's very relatable.
Yeah.
Okay. Your professor at the University of Massachusetts in philosophy, what did you do to get there? So what did you study and how has your scientific path kind of been?
Sure. So I started off in Canada, as I said, in rural Saskatchewan, and did an undergraduate in philosophy at the university there. Then I did a master's degree at Dalhousie University, which is in Atlanta, Canada. And then I moved to the United States. I moved to Ohio for a PhD at the Ohio State University. And then I had a PhD in philosophy, which doesn't leave a lot of opportunities for direct employment other than academia. And I was extremely fortunate enough to actually get a job as a tenure track professor. This was actually my first job, the first job that I've stayed in it at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. And I guess I've been here for 15, 16 years. And I've been sort of promoted to full professor and I'm department chair. And so it's been an interesting journey from humble beginnings to work that I find really, really fascinating. And I feel really lucky and honored to be able to do. I guess I should say that I don't consider myself a scientist, but I do consider myself an academic, mm-hmm. obviously. Yeah.
How came that you decided to study philosophy from the beginning?
Oh, honestly, so there are two answers to this question. One is that I really, really liked that philosophy, especially analytic philosophy, gave me the tools to tell people why I thought they were wrong. That just really fit very, very well with my 18-year-old temperament. I thought, this is great. I get credit for this. I learned tricks. This is amazing. So I really like that. That's the first answer. And then the second answer is that I have an identical twin sister. And when you grow up, especially in a small town, folks sort of, sort you into categories, to try to figure out which one you are. And so she was the smart one and I was the bad one. I was the bad twin. And we were always in the same classroom, of course, because it was such a small town. So the first time I was ever actually in a classroom without her was my first year at a community college run by Benedictine monks. And they were actually German Catholic. They were all German. So yes, all of these German Catholic monks. I was at this community college and I took, again, most of the same classes with my sister because there weren't that many offerings. But I decided to take a philosophy class instead of math. I was sort of sick of calculus. I really didn't know what it was. It fit in my schedule. And I fell in love with it. And I've been lucky to do it ever since.
That's really cool. I'm also very intrigued by the German Catholic monks that teach philosophy somewhere in Canada. I'm very curious about the backstory of that as well, to be honest.
It's called St. Peter's Abbey, and it's this tiny little monastery in the middle of Saskatchewan. Yeah, and they among other things, they run a tiny little community college.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Okay, we are going to start, and I would like to ask you what your focus is in philosophy.
Sure. So I think I have sort of two major research programs. One is the study of the philosopher Immanuel Kant, another German or Prussian, as the case may be, from the 18th century. Really an incredibly influential philosopher and one whose sort of ethical and practical philosophy I find just sort of endlessly fascinating. And so I approach Kant from kind of an unusual perspective because I tend to focus mostly on Kant's issues through a feminist lens. And when I started doing this, no one did it virtually. I mean, so I spent a lot of time convincing the Kantians that, you could talk about oppression and that, Kant's framework was useful for thinking about these questions that come up in oppressive contexts. And I also spent a lot of time convincing the feminists that it was okay to use Kant to do this because Kant was, among other things, a notorious misogynist. And the things he actually says about women tend to be fairly terrible. So, it was a risky project. And again, at the time, this was more than 20 years ago, really no one was using Kant in this way. But it worked. And I ended up putting together my initial sort of dissertation project, which was my first monograph, where I argued, where I used Kant's conception of duties to the self to argue that people who are oppressed have an obligation of self-respect to themselves to resist their own oppression. And the project happily got some uptake, especially I think amongst feminists. It took a little longer for Kantians to jump on board, but it's, at least some have now. And you know, it was again very risky because no one was doing this. But I think now I was lucky enough to sort of be in the right place at the right time. I don't know if you have this experience with your own research, but do you ever sort of find that it doesn't feel like you're making things up? It feels like you're sort of like discovering things. You're discovering the arguments, right? You're sort of carving nature at its joints. And so, and that way, I guess maybe I sort of do think of philosophy as a sort of scientific discipline, right? I didn't feel like I was making up these arguments. It was, listen, these are the conceptual and logical moves that really should be made given this Kantian framework. And I was sort of lucky enough to get there first in some ways. And since then, quite a number of other Kantians have jumped on board, and there are a small but burgeoning crew of Kantian feminists doing really fascinating work. And it's been sort of fun to be part of that. So that was my sort of initial project, sort of, you know, doing Kantian ethics and politics from a feminist point of view. And then in more recent years, I've continued that, but I've also started doing what we call public philosophy, right, which is academic work that isn't geared toward just speaking to other academics, right, in the ivory tower, but instead it's geared toward speaking to the general public. And so that can range from writing op-eds or essays for magazines or newspapers, or doing podcast interviews like this. and the culmination of that project was a book that I wrote for the public, a trade book called Think Like a Feminist, that came out in 2020. And there I really just sort of tried to lay out as much of the sort of framework of analytic feminist philosophy as I could for a general audience. And my reasoning for wanting to do that really was because I think feminist philosophy is fascinating, but it was also political, and it had to do with my upbringing, right? So, I mean, not coming from an academic background, not coming from a community that really was at all familiar with the academy, I knew that people in the sorts of communities that I grew up in would be interested in these ideas if I could couch them in the right way, right? If I could get rid of the unnecessary jargon, if I could unpack these things. And it's really exciting to be able to sort of introduce feminist theory to this wider audience. In some ways, it's sort of an extension of what I do in the classroom as well. I have a lot of first-generation students in the classroom, and I find it really gratifying to do it there. And this book sort of gave me the opportunity to do more of that. So yeah, those are my two big projects, Kant and feminism.
I have two thoughts. My first is, I learned quite a lot about Kant in school because we had philosophy there as well in the last 2 years. And we just did Kant for 2 years, and we never talked about feminism. But we never talked about feminism. So for me, it's like to combine those two concepts to me seems so mind-blowing in a certain way. And I'm not yet sure, like I'm quite sure that I will learn more about your perspective during this conversation, because right now I just have questions.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a very idiosyncratic project when I proposed it.
And the other is, it's actually funny because the book you just mentioned was translated by one professor in his course of the Osnabrück University. And that was also the first time that I stumbled upon your name, because one day I was at the Institute, talked to another person there, and he just came in and gave both of us one of the translations. It's actually a heavy book. I haven't yet read it, I have to admit. I just skimmed through it. But like, this is why I kind of knew that you existed. And then also one of our team members worked on the translation. So kind of there close all the circles between Germany, the US at the moment, you, yes, Canada, and it's just so many tiny circles within one larger circle
looking to each other right now. Right. Yep. Yeah. I was excited to have folks translate the book into German. It's also been translated into French, Korean, and Chinese. So that, I have to say, as an author, is really exciting when your ideas start reaching people that you can't even communicate with, because I don't speak any of these languages or read any of these languages. So it's really exciting when your ideas get that kind of outreach. And I was able to, I taught a few seminar classes in that professor's course on some of my work. And so I was able to meet many of those students, and it was a really, really gratifying process.
I think especially with philosophy, where words matter a lot, I think it's also helpful to talk to the author who wrote a book to translate properly. Mm-hmm. Because I think especially for older texts, there are often a lot of different translations because people interpret words differently. While when the author is still alive and you can ask the author, hey, what did you want to say here? You can, of course, make the translation much better.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Okay, maybe coming back to our actual topic, can you maybe explain to us what ethics are in general, really broadly?
Sure. Ethics. I think of ethics as the systematic philosophical attempt to answer two questions. What should I do? And what sort of person should I be? And so the former sort of falls into the question of the ethics of right action, right? This question of and whether our actions, our thoughts, our intentions, our behaviors, whether they're justified, whether we have good reason for doing what we what we're doing, right? And importantly, the answers to these questions are considered independently of religious contexts, and they're considered independently of local social contexts, right? So ethics really is this question, is this attempt to then sort of step outside the actual sources that most people have for their answer to the question, what should I do? What kind of person should I be? Right. And try to come up with answers that would appeal to people across those differences. Right. So ethics, so an ethical argument should work if it's a good one, right? It should work for someone regardless of their religious background, regardless of their social background, regardless of their cultural background. And in that way, I think it gives us this sort of universal language, right, that we can use to communicate about these really, really important issues of human life across all of our differences.
And just for me, how do ethics relate to morals? I'm not sure if I'm like...
So I tend to sort of view them as synonyms. Mm-hmm. I think some people think about morals as a sort of more personal answer to this question. But for me, I think of ethics as in some ways intensely personal as well, right? Because I don't think that a morality that only applies to you really counts as morality, right? Morality is about how we get along with other people, right? And so so it can't just be, you know, this is my own personal morality. Because, I mean, again, we can have our own personal codes and these sorts of things. And those are important. It's just, that's just not what I take us to be doing when we're answering these ethical questions. Maybe another way to put this is that, so some analytic philosophers say that part of what it is to make a moral claim, to call something right or wrong, has this kind of like universalization built into it, right? So if I say stealing is wrong, I don't just mean stealing is wrong for me. I mean stealing is wrong for everyone, right? That's just what it is to say, to call stealing wrong, right? Or if I say, I think that you should help those in need, right? It's not just, I'm not just saying, I think I should help people who are in need. What I'm saying is, I think I should help people in need, and I think you should do that too. That's just what it is to call things right or wrong.
Okay. And the second question, like, I think you said, what kind of person do I want to be?
Yeah.
I find it hard to imagine all of those things outside of like my personal context. But
sure.
Could you give some background on that question too?
Sure. So in some ways, I think this is the probably the oldest way of approaching morality, right? Because it comes from the ancient Greeks, it comes from the virtue ethics of people like Plato and Aristotle. Right. So these ancient Greek philosophers really thought the sort of central question of morality was, what kind of person should I be? What kind of character should I have? And they thought that right action would flow naturally from a good character. Right. So they thought that really what we should do is try to sort of cultivate these good characters by habit. Right. And then we would just sort of automatically do the right thing. And if we wanted to know what the right thing to do is, well, then we should model our behavior on an ideally virtuous person. Right. So for Plato, that was Socrates. Right. And that's actually the role that Socrates plays in all of the Socratic dialogues, is this sort of ideally virtuous person. Right. And so contemporary virtue ethicists, you know, try to sort of approach morality from this perspective still, really sort of focusing on issues of character. I tend to sort of think that the making the questions of character central, and then making questions of right action sort of secondary to that central question of character. I think in some ways it's very good because it really sort of captures how we educate ourselves morally, how we educate future generations, right? When you think about, like, you know, if you have any experience interacting with a child that you're sort of responsible for, one of the things you realize pretty quickly is that what you're worried about is sort of making them into a good person, right? Molding their character, right? And so if you find out, you know, that, you know, they're doing something like taking a magnifying glass and using it to roast ants or something, right? Like, your initial concern probably isn't, oh, those poor ants, right? Your initial concern is, what does this say about the character of my child, right? Right. So I think that virtue ethics is really, really good at making sense of their kind of like daily moral lives, right? Both our moral education and also just sort of how we approach morality, right? We tend to sort of think about wanting to be a good person, having the right kind of character, cultivating certain virtues, avoiding certain vices. So that works, I think, really, really well for a really nice, robust description of morality. But the problem with virtue ethics is that it has a much harder time solving those hard cases, solving the cases where we don't know what an ideally virtuous person would do, or if we disagree about what an ideally virtuous person would do. Right. And this is where these other approaches, I use Kant, but there are also utilitarian approaches. These other ethical approaches really sort of make the question of right action, this question of what should I do, central to morality. Right. And so then we answer those questions first, and then the questions of character are sort of derivative on these initial questions of right action. So again, so philosophers sort of go back and forth about which one they want to prioritize. I tend to sort of prioritize Kant and his attempt to really give us an answer to the question of what the right thing to do is. But even Kant himself has a doctrine of virtue. He's got the whole half of his Metaphysics of Morals, his sort of big magnum opus in his morality, talks about virtue. So it's not as if these things are completely separate, but it's just a sort of, it's a matter of focus of, you know, a priority, I think.
Okay. So you basically look at the problem of ethics and morality from Kant's perspective.
Yeah.
For somebody who has no idea of Kant and what Kant was all about, could you give a little bit of background? And secondly, you just mentioned utilitarianism. Could you then also try to give a little bit of background about that and how that's different from Kant?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think I'll do utilitarianism first, because utilitarianism is very easy to give a sort of 30-second gloss on. Kant is not. So let's get utilitarianism out of the way, okay? So utilitarianism is a form of consequentialism, right? Which means that it's a moral view that tells us that if you want to know what the right thing to do is, you have to look at its consequences. And a utilitarian says the best moral consequences are those that maximize utility. And what utilitarians mean by utility is basically happiness. Happiness, pleasure, again, different utilitarians unpack this in various interesting ways. But the basic idea is that the right thing to do is whatever sort of creates the most happiness or pleasure for the most beings involved. Any being capable of experiencing happiness or pleasure is morally relevant to this calculation. And so the right thing to do is to whatever action causes the most happiness and minimizes the most suffering, right? And so utilitarians, it really is a kind of mathematical thing here, right? Bentham, you know, gave us what he called a fellacific calculus, right? It was, you know, invented before computers, right? It was the sort of 18th, 19th centuries. They really didn't have in mind a sort of supercomputer that could take all these inputs about, you know, how much happiness an action would cause and give us the outputs and tell us what the right thing to do is. So it's a very kind of scientific and scientistic approach to morality. I think it's wrong. And I prefer Kant, right? And so the utilitarianism, consequentialism is contrasted with Kant. Kant's ethics are what's known as deontological or duty-based, right? So for Kant, the right thing to do is whatever is done with the right intentions or done for the right reason, right? So we're not supposed to sort of look at the consequences of our actions when determining what's right or wrong. We're supposed to look at our reasons for doing what we're doing. And if our reasons are good, and he gives us a machinery to evaluate those reasons, then if we have the right reasons, then we can know what we've done is right. And why I like Kant rather than utilitarians like Jeremy Bentham or John Stuart Mill is that I think really sort of appreciating this requires appreciating what Kant was worried about when he sort of set his morality apart from utilitarian perspectives, right? And basically, or consequentialist perspectives. basically, I think Kant points out that a couple of things about our human nature, right? So I think actually how Kant understands what we're like as human beings is really kind of central to understanding his morality, right? And that makes sense, right? If you want to know what's right and wrong, you have to sort of, have some sense of the beings that we're talking about here. And so I think Kant points out that we are really, really, really good at making exceptions for ourselves. We're really, really good at coming up with these fantastically complex, intelligent justifications for doing what we want to do. That in part is where morality comes from in general, right? This our rational ability, our ability to set and pursue ends according to reason and to evaluate those ends, with this complex rational process. Kant calls this our humanity, right? This ability that we have to set and pursue ends in this way. That's really important, is where morality comes from. But we also have this tendency to use this ability for self-interested purposes, right? And that goes against the point of morality, right? If the point of morality is to come up with answers to questions that are fair for everyone, right, that aren't self-interested, right, then what morality should do for Kant is to sort of correct for this all too human tendency that we have. He sometimes calls it radical evil or our unsocial social ability. These are all the English translations of these terms. So it's not as if Kant has this really bleak conception of human nature. He doesn't think that we're like completely, fallen individuals, right? But he wants to be kind of realistic about, the pitfalls that we tend to be, subject to. And so he says morality needs to kind of correct for that. And if morality is about consequences, then what we're going to do is we're going to be sort of overly confident in our ability to predict the consequences of our actions. Right? Because think about this. How confident are you about the results of any of your actions? Give me a number. Again, it depends, right? How confident are you that the weather tomorrow will be snowy?
Not very.
Right, but meteorologists can give you some kind of percentage here, right? To sort of make sense of this, right? How confident are you that the sun will rise tomorrow?
Quite.
Fairly confident. Are you 100% confident that the sun will rise tomorrow? You shouldn't be, right? I mean, what happens if, an asteroid hits us, or the sun blows up? I mean, again, is this likely? No. Is it possible? Yes. Right? And that's because whenever we're reasoning about the future, we're engaging in what philosophers call inductive reasoning. This is how science works, right? Science makes predictions about the future based on past events, right? And to be clear, this is a really good kind of reasoning, right? We build bridges and they don't fall down. We cure diseases, right? It's a very effective way of interacting with the environment, right? But it's not 100% certain, right? Now, compare your certainty that the sun will rise tomorrow to your certainty to a mathematical question, right? How certain are you that the answer to two plus two is equal to four? How certain are you about that?
Pretty certain.
100%, right? There's no possible world in which 2 + 2 = 5, right? Depends, you really can rules. Be complete. given the mathematical system, right? Yeah. Given the way we understand mathematics, right? And so given that, right, that's what philosophers call deductive certainty, right? And it's completely certain, right? So if you think of mathematics as the kind of ideal model or logic, right? You can sort of plug the rules of logic. And it's certain, right? That these things are always going to be true. And so that's Kant's goal for morality, right? Kant doesn't want something as important as morality to be left up to chance, to be left up to probabilities. Specifically because he thinks if we do that, then this self-interested tendency we have to make exceptions of ourselves is going to just, ruin the whole thing, right? So he wants us to have a way to evaluate our reasoning deductively so that we know with certainty whether the reasons behind our actions are good ones. And I think there's something to that. I really do. And so what Kant does in his moral system, and again, I warned you, this is not something you can capture in 30 seconds or 30 years. But I think there are kind of like two central intuitions that Kant formulates in his moral philosophy. One is the intuition that there's something about us that makes us special from the moral point of view, right? So sometimes we talk about this in terms of human rights. Sometimes we talk about this in terms of having a soul, right? There are different ways of understanding this, but there's something to the intuition, right? That there are, there are certain things that it's not okay to do to someone, regardless of the consequences, right? It's never okay to torture an innocent person, no matter how good the consequences, right? So Kant gives us a really, really, really clear, really solid foundation for this intuition. The second intuition, and for Kant fans out there, this is what he does in his formula of humanity, which is one of the ways he understands the categorical imperative. We don't need to go down the rabbit hole of the jargon. I'm just flagging it here. So yeah, that's what he does in the formula of humanity. He makes sense of this idea that we have rights. And the second intuition that Kant formalizes is a little bit more complex. And basically what Kant shows us is that there's something not quite right about the golden rule. Now, I guess this is a question. Do you call it the golden rule in Germany?
Yeah, we do. We do.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay. So what's the golden rule? Let's remind the audience.
I only know the German version. So,
okay.
But basically,
It
says that if you, like, you shouldn't do what you don't want to another person, what you don't want to have done to yourself. So you shouldn't treat other people in a way you don't want to be treated as well.
Yes. Yeah. That's right. That's exactly right. I love it. It's apparently this is if you look at all these sort of different cultures, both now and historically, if you're looking for sort of like one candidate for a cross-cultural universal moral rule, it's probably some version of this. It's fascinating, right? So in English we call it the golden rule. People usually say, I unpack it as, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Right. And it's a pretty good rule, right? It's great for teaching kids morality, right? And it's great for really sort of capturing, again, what we're doing with moral thinking, right? It really motivates the idea that morality requires empathy, it requires impartiality, it requires not putting ourselves first, involves treating everyone equally, right? So it captures a lot, right? And again, like I said, it's really good for capturing or for making a sense of how we can teach children morality. And so are you like me in sort of having learned this very young? Do you remember when you learned the golden rule?
Like my mom taught ethics in school, so.
Oh, perfect.
I grew up with it.
There's like a German saying about it, I guess. I don't have any context, but when it just came up, my grandma used to say like, what you don't want done to you also don't do to others.
Yeah, that's basically the German version of the golden rule.
That's my grandma used to say this when I was a child. So.
Exactly. I think it's funny. I mean, that's why I ask my students this all the time. And people tend to have really strong memories of either the first time they learned it or something, again, sort of really influential adult who taught it to them. It really tends to stick with us. So let me tell you about my version of this. So I was in second grade. So I was about 7. And I remember the teacher actually had it written up on the wall in this big sparkly poster board. It had glitter on it. I love that glitter. So I remember being 7 and having it up on the wall. And at some point, one of my friends stabbed another one of my friends in the hand with a pencil. I think it was just 7-year-olds, being terrible, right? Classic 7-year-old behavior, right? And so it was my friend Mark who had done this. And of course the teacher's angry and she's, pointing at this poster on the wall saying, Mark, how would you feel if Ryan stabbed you in the hand with a pencil? I remember we were all terrified that he would have lead poisoning because we call them the pencil leads because we're 7, right? But Mark was smart, right? So what's the clever 7-year-old's response to the teacher who says, how would you feel if he did that to you?
I wouldn't mind.
Yeah, exactly. I don't care. You can stab me, right? And it's a jerk answer, but it's actually very clever, right? Because so Mark had sort of put his finger on there's a loophole in the golden rule, right? Which is that if you're willing to have bad things done to you, you're actually morally permitted to do anything, right? Which is not something we actually want, right? As long as you're a sociopath, it's okay to be a sociopath. Like, no. The whole point of the golden rule is that we're supposed to block behaviors like this. But it's a loophole. It really is, right? And so what Kant does is he blocks that loophole. And he does this by appealing to something different. So when you think about it, the golden rule appeals to our desires. It appeals to our subjective preferences. It appeals to what we happen to want, right? Hoping that most people are not going to want to be stabbed in the hand with a pencil, right? Or, hoping that most people are going to want other people to share their toys with them or whatever it is, right? And it works most of the time, right? But in those cases where someone doesn't have the appropriate desires or preferences, it doesn't work. Right? And so Kant recognizes that we can't just appeal to our desires, right? Because our desires are idiosyncratic, they're personal, right? They vary across people, right? We might have the wrong, we have the desire to do the wrong thing all the time, right? So in part, what morality has to do is sort of rein our emotional impulses in, right? So it can't just appeal to these desires, right? So what Kant then appeals to is a sort of consistency test, right? And this is where it gets complex. We don't need to go into it here. This is his formula of the universal law of the categorical imperative. But what he does here is appeal to something other than our desires. He appeals to this consistency test where we're consistent in the right kind of way. And he means a sort of logical consistency here. Then we can know with certainty that what we're proposing and doing is right or wrong. Sorry, I can't answer the question. We talk about Kant in even 10 minutes, but I've done my best. That's as short as I can get it.
I think you did very well. I'm currently trying to basically sort all the information in my head. could you, so the utilitarianist approach is kind of opposed to Kant. Could you give like an example where they would have different views? Because for me right now, all of this seems very theoretic and abstract.
Sure.
And I feel like...
sure. So do you have the German equivalent of the phrase, the ends justify the means?
Yes.
Okay. This is a good way of really understanding how these theories come apart, right? So all you have to do is come up with an example of a situation where certain people are asked or required to make sacrifices for the common good. Right, so we can look sort of historically at things like the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Right, it ended World War II. Right, so the moral justification for this bombing, right, and again, to be clear, like this was hundreds of thousands of innocent people being, you know, functionally boiled alive, right, vaporized. It's horrible, right? So he's a utilitarian, right? We think, okay, so things are right or wrong insofar as they increase pleasure or diminish suffering. I mean, bombing Hiroshima and Nagasaki caused an incredible amount of suffering, but there's still a potentially a utilitarian justification for it, right? The only justification you're going to get is utilitarian. And the argument there is it's true that it caused a lot of suffering, but it prevented more suffering in the long run, right? So the argument is that, you know, the war was you know, over in Europe, but it was going to sort of continue on in the Pacific theater for a very long time. And a lot more people would have suffered in the long run by the war dragging on probably potentially for years, right? And so the utilitarian justification here is the ends justify the means, right? So we can do this seemingly horrible act, which is to say cause a lot of suffering, because the utilitarian calculation tells in favor of less suffering in the long run, right? Again, we're making predictions about the future, right? That's a utilitarian argument for these murders of massacres of innocent civilians, right? A Kantian would just say, nope, sorry. You can't, like, first of all, like, okay, like notice your confidence in predicting that it is actually going to cause less suffering, right? We actually don't know, right? We don't know that the war would have continued on, right? It's predicting about the future. And we can't know with certainty, right? We did one thing and this thing happened, but we can't know what would have happened if we'd done something different, right? And so a Kantian would say, listen, there are just certain things you're not allowed to do, right? And like vaporizing hundreds of thousands of innocent people is one of them, right? It doesn't matter, even if it's true that the consequences are better, which again, we can't know with certainty, but even if we're fairly certain that the consequences would be better, it's just wrong. It's just immoral no matter what. Right. So yeah, so this is a really clear case of where these two views come apart. I should say that most of the time, the views actually give us the same answer, right? So it's, you know, and this is, I think students take an ethics class and they come away thinking that utilitarians and Kantians disagree about everything and virtue ethicists disagree with them too, right? And I think in part, this is just a sort of an artifact of, it's easier as a professor to really have your students understand the theories if you focus on the cases where they come apart, right? But most of the time, they give us the same answer. Again, they get that same answer from very different directions, right? But they converge on the same answer, right? Don't steal, don't lie, don't cheat, don't cause unnecessary suffering, these sorts of things, right? So yeah, I think it's really sort of important to keep in mind that, like, a lot of our moral questions aren't
dilemmas, right? They're not difficult questions, right? It's more like we often, you know what the right thing to do is. We know what a good person to do, what a good person would do, right? What we don't know is, what we have a hard time doing is doing the right thing, even though we know it's the right thing, right? These questions of motivation and these sorts of things. But a Kantian utilitarian would give us, again, the same answer from very different directions, much of the time, but again, not all the time.
Thank you. That makes a lot of sense.
Good.
Maybe before we go deeper into our next, larger block of content for this episode, could you maybe just again repeat how you came to connect feminism, sex, gender, etc. to philosophy at the first place?
Yes. So do you mean to philosophy or to Kant in particular?
First philosophy and then Kant.
Okay. So I think in part this is because it's because I was a first generation university student. And so I didn't have a very clear sense of what counted as a respectable research program, what counted as the sorts of questions we were supposed to focus on. I had no idea, right? I knew what I was interested in. And I didn't know any of the philosophy canon. So I had very few preconceived notions. And obviously that made many parts of my philosophical education much more difficult and take a lot longer. But it also sort of cleared out a space for me to come up with novel approaches, ask novel questions, right? So oppression theorists have there's a version of oppression theory called standpoint theory or standpoint epistemology. And what standpoint theorists argue is that a marginalized social positions can actually be epistemically advantageous. A lot of jargon there. What that means is that people who are oppressed, right? People who aren't very powerful in their society, very respected in their society. People who are poor, people who are queer, people who are women rather than men, people of color, these sorts of things. It's true that this marginalization often makes your life worse, and it can also often make it harder to know things, right? If you don't have access to education. But it's also sometimes the case that these marginalized perspectives can set you up to know things better than people with more power. And this can work in a couple of ways. One way it works is that you just don't have a vested interest in lying to yourself about a status quo that you don't benefit from, right? So it, especially when it comes to issues of sort of oppression, right? The thought is that people who are marginalized are often better situated to know what's wrong, what the problems are, and what potential solutions might be, precisely because they're marginalized, right? In other cases, marginalized standpoints can be epistemically advantageous. And again, epistemically advantageous just means more likely to give you knowledge, more likely to get you to the truth, right? Epistemology is just the philosophical study of how we know things, right? So marginalized perspectives can be epistemically advantageous sometimes because I think this was the case in my case, I didn't know what the rules were, so I didn't know that I was breaking them, and then that meant that I could find things that other people hadn't thought of, right? Find ways to ask these questions that other people hadn't thought of, right? So I think in some ways my marginalized upbringing, right, coming from a very poor family, right, being relatively uneducated, these sorts of things, it actually ended up working in my favor. And so I didn't know that you weren't really supposed to talk about feminism, to talk about these issues of social justice with philosophy. Because I was interested in feminism just for its own sake. I was politically a feminist. And I knew that I liked philosophy. And so by the time I kind of figured out, oh, wait, a lot of philosophers really don't take feminism seriously. And also a lot of feminists really don't take analytic philosophy seriously, right? By the time I figured that out, I was too far down the rabbit hole with both. I was too committed to both, right? To really kind of feel like I had to choose. And so I spent a lot of time really sort of thinking, no, I want to do this. I want to be a feminist, both practically in my activism, but also theoretically, right, in my academic work. But I want to use the canon of philosophy to do that. And I'm stubborn, so I did.
And how far is political feminism different from philosophical feminism?
Well, I guess there's a couple of differences. One, just sort of in the academy, a lot of the feminist theory that there is doesn't go on in philosophy departments. It goes on in gender studies departments, and also like places like English departments or rhetoric departments. And so these departments, so they have a sort of theoretical canon that isn't the same philosophical canon that analytic philosophers have in particular, right? So I should give you another distinction. Philosophers carve up their terrain between analytic and continental. Okay, so analytic philosophers tend to be sort of like focused on logic. The way I like to sort of say it is that, you know, analytic philosophers are really interested in the trees and continental philosophers are really interested in the forest. Right, so the big questions. Right? The continental philosophers, they tend to be French, they tend to be German, and they tend to focus on these big questions about, you know, like the meaning of life. Right, existentialism comes in here, post-structuralism. Right, all of that stuff is a kind of theoretical approaches that analytic philosophers just don't do. Right, so analytic philosophers, again, they tend to sort of be more focused on making logical reasons. So it's very smart, you know, defending very, very small claims very, very well, as opposed to making very, very broad claims. Right? And in the canon of social and political philosophy, in analytic philosophy, it tends to really sort of like be tied to the liberal social contract tradition, right? So starting with people like Hobbes, through Locke, through Mill, through Rousseau, through Kant. So Kant is one of those figures that I think both analytic and continental folks try to claim him. But what ends up happening is that you get wildly different interpretations of Kant from these different traditions. And again, when I started, I was an analytic philosopher through and through. I just thought it was, you know, obviously the continentals were wrong. I no longer think that because, you know, I think as one ages, hopefully one becomes less arrogant. But now I just like this tradition better. I like the tools of analytic philosophy. It just appeals to me. So in some ways, it's almost an aesthetic judgment. So I like doing philosophy this way. I like answering philosophical questions this way. I find this canon fascinating. I like reading folks in it. But I think that folks are approaching the same questions from the continental perspective or these other theoretical perspectives are doing really interesting, important work. And I do my best to sort of try to understand it when I can. I just don't pretend that, you know, we're, you know, that there's only one right way to do this stuff. So, yeah.
Okay. So let's go a little bit back to Kant. So you wrote your book and also Kant's perspective on feminism. Mm-hmm. Could you explain that a little bit? Because especially after you mentioned earlier that he was a misogynist, I think that's very interesting.
Yes, absolutely. So let me tell you how I came to this project, right? And again, this really was for me an experience of, you know, like finding the conceptual space there and then feeling like I was just mapping it. So I was reading a book of essays by an American author named David Foster Wallace. And in one of these essays, he talks about being at a fair with a friend of his, where like a carnival. So because he was a journalist, he had a press pass. And so they were there while the carnival was still setting up. It was this massive state fair. And his friend really liked the carnival rides. And so she was excited because she got to sort of go on the carnival rides before the fair was open. And of course he was too afraid to go on the rides. He knew that would make him sick. So he stayed off. Right. And so she was the only person on the ride because the carnival was still being set up. And while she was on the ride, the ride was called the Zipper. And actually, if you Google my book, I'll send a copy of a link to the book. I think it's now out of print, but you can probably find it online. But the cover photo of that book is actually a photo of this ride, the Zipper. And it basically looks almost like a chainsaw, where you have these individual little cars that spin around on this larger wheel that also spins around, right? It's just designed to make you maximally sick, right? This woman is on this ride and she's loving it, right? She's screaming. And then the people, the person operating the ride stopped it while she was at the top of this sort of chainsaw thing. And so her cart flipped upside down. And her dress fell over her head, right? And he did this intentionally. He knew this would happen, right? And then he was down at the ground making lewd comments about this woman whose dress it was over her head to his friends on the ground. Right? And so her friend, right, the journalist, was there the whole time, right? And was just sort of like kvetching about what he should do, right? Should he say something? He was really worried about it. He ended up doing nothing. But yeah, then they brought her down, and she came off the ride, and she's, you know, full of adrenaline, and he told her, listen, I don't know if you realize what was going on down here, but he did that intentionally. And they were, you know, they were like looking at your body and making all of these crass remarks about it. And she said, okay. Like, and he said, well, do you want to do something about it? Like, do you want, we could complain to the Ferris management. We could go talk to them. Do you want to do something? And her response fascinates me to this day. Her response was, assholes are just assholes. What's getting upset about it going to do except keep me from getting to have fun? Right. So she took herself to have like, no, I mean, like they're assholes. There's nothing I need to do about it. Let's just move on. Right. And it stuck in my head, this question, because I think part of why it stuck in my head is because it's such a mundane experience. I suspect there are very few female bodied people who haven't had some version of that experience. Right. It's so mundane. And there's this question, like what should we do about it? Right. And so what I argued, the more I thought about it, you know, I think there's some kind of obligation here, right? Some kind of obligation to herself to do something, right? That she has this obligation, not to other people, because this is just something she has to do for herself, is just do something about it. Maybe she doesn't have to, you know, go to the management, but maybe she just has to, you know, flip the guys off or swear at them or even just tell herself that was messed up. I don't deserve that. People like me don't deserve that, right? So it struck me that there were actually a lot of kind of like morally obligatory responses, right? And that if she were just to say, no, you know, it's fine. What they did to me wasn't harmful. What they did to me is perfectly socially acceptable. Boys will be boys. Like that's actually a moral failure on her part, right? So one of the things I wanted to do was sort of actually figure out how to understand assholes are just assholes, right? Is she just, you know, failing to resist? Or maybe what she's doing here is actually sort of telling herself they don't get to ruin my day. They don't get to tell me what kind of day to have. Maybe it's a kind of internal resistance, right? But it really sort of just got me thinking about this question of what the obligations of resistance are for people to themselves, right? Because a lot of oppression theory, a lot of feminist theory, a lot of anti-racist theory is focused on the question of the obligations that we have to other people who are oppressed, right? Why we should be anti-racist, why we should fight homophobia, right? And those are all important, but they're also like fairly well theorized. Like lots of people have answers to these questions about what we owe other people who are oppressed. And it was just one of those things. It was a lacuna. People hadn't really asked the question, well, what do we owe to ourselves? And so I started off down the road of this project, and I realized pretty quickly is that I wanted to talk about self-respect. It struck me that self-respect was really important here. And interestingly enough, Kant is the only moral philosopher really historically who has anything like an account of the duty of self-respect as a moral duty, right? Virtually every other historical philosopher, thinks that it's sort of a category mistake to think that we could have a moral duty to ourselves of self-respect, right? And the basic thought here is that duties to themselves, like the whole point of a moral duty is that it's supposed to govern interactions between two people, two or more people, right? So they argue that it's sort of incoherent to think that we have a moral duty to ourselves, right? Because if you think about a sort of like example of, sort of canonical example of a moral obligation would be like a promise, right? So if I promise to meet you for lunch, right? I have an obligation to meet you for lunch. But if I text you and I say, hey, listen, something's come up, can we reschedule? You can let me out of that obligation, right? You, the other party, can free me from that obligation, and then I no longer have the obligation, right? That's how obligations tend to work, right? But if you have an obligation to yourself, notice what happens, right? You just let yourself out of the obligation immediately, right? So it's almost like it's incoherent to have an obligation to yourself. This is what most other philosophers think. Kant doesn't think so. Kant thinks we can get around it. His answer to the question is not that interesting. But what is interesting is Kant's account of self-respect, right? This moral duty of self-respect. And Kant says basically, and the philosophical justification for this is great, right? It's just the same reason I have to respect you, right? Using his formula of humanity, right? This idea that we... There are restrictions on how we can treat people. I have to respect you in virtue of your rational nature. I have to recognize that you're someone who can set and pursue her own ends, who can figure out what she wants, how to get it, and decide that for herself, right? And so moral respect involves not getting in your way of, you know, your project and also helping you when I can, right? But notice we can have that same obligation to ourselves, right? We can have that same respect for ourselves, right? And failures of self-respect are failures to do that, right? Failures to respect this thing about us, our ability to, you know, be autonomous agents setting our own life plans. We can fail to do that, right? And those are moral failures. And so I realize, again, not fully appreciating just how many people this would anger, using this, you know, the parts of the Kantian machinery to answer this question, I embarked on the project. and wrote a dissertation on it, wrote a book on it, wrote many articles on it, and really just sort of came up with this account of duties to the self to resist oppression using Kant's framework. Ended up being fascinating. And it ended up being one of those things where, again, because I didn't know Kant, I'm a self-taught Kantian. I had never taken a course on Kant, not in grad school, not in as an undergrad. There weren't any people who taught Kant's practical philosophy in the schools I went to. So I had to teach myself Kant, which was interesting. I didn't speak or read German. I still don't. Everything I read is in translation. I just had to, and again, when you teach yourself something as complex as Kant, you go down a lot of blind alleys, you take a lot of wrong turns, but eventually, like, you might come up with an interpretation that's unique, idiosyncratic. And that's what I ended up doing. So I have this account of Kant where I really focus on this formula of vanity, this duty of self-respect that we have, in impressive contexts, right? Where, people have a duty to resist, right? I focus a lot on the objection that this would be too demanding, right? That you're sort of like, if you argue that there's an obligation like this, then really what you're going to end up doing pretty quickly is blaming the victim, right? Because obviously, you know, you don't want that, right? So I spend actually a lot of the book responding to this question about why you can argue that people have a duty of self-respect to resist, but avoid blaming the victim. And what I discovered was that Kant had this other piece of his practical philosophy that was actually incredibly useful. And that's the idea of an imperfect duty, right? So Kant and Kantians distinguish two kinds of duties. Perfect duties are exceptionalist, right? You have a duty or an obligation to tell the truth, right? To refrain from stealing, lying, causing unnecessary harm, right? And these things are exceptionalist, right? There are no exceptions, right? But Kant says there's another kind of duty. He calls it imperfect. And it doesn't... the kind of exceptions it permits are very interesting, right? Because it's not just this, like, oh, once in a while, you don't have to follow morality. You get a get out of jail free card. No, that's not what an imperfect duty is. But rather, imperfect duties are a recognition that we're finite beings, right? We don't have unlimited resources, right? So if I have an obligation to help people in need, and Kant says we do, there's an obligation of beneficence. If that obligation were to require me to act in every instance, I would run out of time and money virtually immediately, right? So does this mean that I'm not a charitable person because I don't give to every single charitable opportunity that presents itself to myself? No, right? It just that's the nature of the kind of finite beings we are, that we help, you can count as a charitable person, but sometimes refrain from acting charitably, right? And also importantly, there are lots of things that you can do that count as acting charitable, right? There isn't just one thing you have to do, right? So there's a kind of latitude in action. It's translated in English as wiggle room. I don't know the German word, but I've had German speakers say, yeah, that's actually a pretty good translation. There's a wiggle room in action that you have for these duties. And again, it's not just like, oh, I don't have to do it because I don't feel it, but it's rather, there's a wiggle room in sometimes being permitted to refrain from action and a wiggle room in choosing which action satisfies the duty, right? There's more than one action that counts as satisfying the duty. So I argue that this duty of self-respect, self-respecting resistance, is an imperfect duty, right? There are lots of things that count as resisting, right? So back to the initial example, right? The woman can complain to the Paris management, right? She could write a letter to the editor, right? She could scream at the men themselves, right? She could just tell herself, again, that she deserves better, right? These are all ways of resisting oppression, right? There isn't just one necessarily way to do it. And importantly, she might actually sometimes be able to count as resisting her oppression. And, you know, some days that means like not letting these people ruin your day and just go and have fun. Right. So it ended up being one of those cases where the details of Kant actually ended up being incredibly resourceful. Yeah.
To me, it sounds a bit like it also depends a lot on how a person herself or themselves interpret a situation. So it's not a black and white situation, it's rather how you yourself feel about or interpret what has happened and how you want to react on it, rather than just saying, okay, you should always react by defending yourself or offending another person who has offended you in a certain way.
Yeah. So, I mean, it allows for like a lot of serious complexity, right, in analyzing the situation, right? At the same time, it's not anything goes, right? I mean, it still leaves room for error, right? It leaves room for you to say to a friend, I think you're deceiving yourself when you tell yourself that was okay. Right. I think that, you know, like that no, this isn't self-respecting. I think you're lying to yourself about it. Right. So it's not as if, you know, we necessarily know whether we're resisting or not. Right. So it leaves room for that. Right. But at the same time, it's just, there's a lot of complexity that it permits, which is great without collapsing into kind of relativism.
I'm still kind of thinking about Kant and me having obligations towards myself. And I'm still trying to, like, so can I try and give an example where I take this out of the context of oppression?
Sure.
So basically, yeah, when I sign up to go for a run tomorrow with Elisa, I have an obligation towards her. But if I say, oh, I want to become a runner, and I set myself tomorrow at 12, I'm going to go for a run, then I have the obligation towards myself to actually also go and do that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly right. And there's a sense in which, like, you've let yourself down if you don't do that. So the example that Kant used, again, Kant doesn't talk about oppression. Kant doesn't do any of this, right? Kant's example is the duty that we have to develop our natural talents. Right. So everyone has certain kind of natural talents that you're like naturally, maybe you're a natural runner. Right. But again, that doesn't necessarily, like, you have to work at that. You have to cultivate that. Right. And so Kant says, right, that we have this duty to ourselves to cultivate our natural talents, which involves a lot of hard work. Right. Whether we're musical or whether we're intellectual or whether we're athletic, whatever it is. Right. It takes a lot of hard work. Right. But we have these natural talents. And Kant says, like, we're failing in this moral duty to ourselves, this duty of respect to ourselves, if we don't do what we can to cultivate those talents. Yeah.
I find that so interesting because obviously it's a lot easier to say when I'm just going to the run by myself to be like, well, the weather's not nice and I'm kind of tired and it's cold. I don't really feel like it. Well, if I like tell Elisa like, oh, tomorrow at 12, we're going. And then Elisa texts me like 10 minutes before I'm ready to go. Like, I'm like, oh, okay. We're doing that.
We're
going. Yeah. It doesn't matter that it's cold. Doesn't matter that it's raining. Apparently we're doing that. And I find it very interesting because one is obviously much easier/harder than the other because it's way easier to let yourself down in this context because you have more, nobody's keeping account of what you're doing. So you just do what you do. And I think I think it's a very interesting approach.
It is. And I think it really sort of captures something intuitive about, you know, when you think about someone of like with integrity, right? There's someone who, you know, who has their own values, their own standards, and they stick to them, right? They don't let themselves off the hook when it would be easy, right? And I think, you know, Kant gives us a really, really complex and interesting and sophisticated way of understanding this, which I think is actually interesting. Like, so I don't know, but I think maybe in Germany, but especially in America, right, there's this sort of culture of like self-care, self-help, right? Where it's also been sort of commodified in really, really disgusting ways, right? And I think what Kant does in part is, once you can really start to understand this, is that it gives us a way to kind of take it, you know, take this stuff back from the commodification, right? And sort of see this as, you know, something that we're doing for ourselves, not in a kind of commodified way, but in a way that really sort of like makes us into the kind of people that we want to be.
Yeah, I see that also like a lot in online self-care culture where people just basically give into everything they feel like. And sometimes, this is something I've wondered before, if sometimes self-care doesn't mean kind of self-discipline also. To a certain degree. Obviously, there's limits to everything. I'm not saying people should like physically or emotionally harm themselves. This is not what I'm trying to express.
Yeah.
But sometimes I wonder, because like if you take exercise, for example, I usually know I will feel better after I have exercised. That's just a fact, how it usually goes for me. But sometimes, obviously, I come up with reasons to not do it. And sometimes the better thing for me to do is actually to be like, okay, even though I don't feel like it, I'm just going to push through this and then feel better later, rather than just lying on the couch and feeling semi-good now and semi-good later.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I also thought about self-worth and self-care more in a way of deciding on what is right in the moment. Just because, like, even when, just to come back to the example to go for a run, even when Sophie and I have a date for going for a run and I realize, oh, I've got a cold now and I can't go running because it would harm my body, it would be an act of self-care and also self-obligation to then tell her, hey, sorry, I'm sick, I can't go on a run with you. But by that, I would kind of put the obligation towards myself above the obligation towards Sophie. Mm-hmm. And again, also when I decide for myself that I want to go for a run, if I notice, okay, I'm sick today, I would put the obligation to take care of my health above my goal for going for a run. So it's always kind of a deciding on which obligation also one wants to follow, which mm-hmm. makes it even more complex now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But importantly, Kant would say, like, there's a right answer here, right? There is a prioritization that is the right answer, right?
Maybe to come back to your example of the woman who has been humiliated by those other people, maybe in this context, what would you say does it mean to be a woman? So where is, like, what is it to be a woman? Just in a society where we always live with a male gaze and mm-hmm. always are to a certain degree sexualized, etc.
Yeah. So I think what this analysis does is give us another way to understand the harms of objectification, the harms of harassment, right? And so it's a moral framework that allows us to really, really understand what the moral harm is here, right? What this failure of respect is coming from without, and then also give us a moral framework to understand why we have an obligation to do something about it, right? So basically what I'm doing here is sort of using the resources of Kant to help out oppression theory, questions in oppression theory, right? Feminist questions, anti-racist questions. And that was really kind of the subject of a lot of my early work. I really sort of thought, yep, we use Kant, we can ignore the really terrible stuff that Kant actually says, and we can use this Kantian framework basically unmodified to answer these interesting questions in oppression theory, right? And that was, you know, probably the first 15 years of my research program. And then at some point, I started taking more seriously the work of Charles Mills. He was a fascinating moral philosopher, moral and political philosopher, who just died a couple of years ago. He was Jamaican, lived in Canada and the US. And he talked a lot about what he called non-ideal theory, and really sort of popularized this way of approaching moral questions. And so for Mills, non-ideal theory is philosophy or philosophical theorizing that recognizes that we live in an unjust world, right? That we live in a world that is fantastically racist and sexist and homophobic, right? We don't live in an ideally just society. That's just not the world we live in. And I think everyone has to agree to that. It's just manifestly true, right? But it's strange, given that when you actually look at all of these, you know, centuries of moral and political philosophy, it's common philosophical practice to assume an ideally just society, right? And so we talk about political philosophy under the assumption that society is completely just, and then we, you know, figure out what the rules of justice are in this idealized thought experiment. And so Mills comes along and says, why are we doing this? Right? Why are we assuming that the world is not the way it is? And notice, importantly, notice whose interests it serves when we do this. It serves the interests of the people who benefit from this society. Right? So his main interlocutor was a philosopher named John Rawls, who is probably the most influential political philosopher in analytic philosophy of the last century, incredibly influential philosopher. And Rawls, yeah, just straightforwardly admitted, yeah, like he said explicitly, yeah, I'm assuming these sort of ideally just conditions, and we figure out what are the rules for. So he was doing what's called distributive justice. So he was trying to figure out, right, how do we most fairly distribute the resources in our society, right? That's his question for political philosophers, right? And, you know, different political philosophies answer this question in different ways, right? You know, a socialist or a communist was saying, right, the most fair way to distribute resources is kind of like centralized egalitarian thing, right? An egalitarian has a different way of sort of understanding egalitarianism, right? A capitalist or, you know, libertarian, right, would say the most just way to distribute the stuff is like, you know, everyone gets whatever they can fight for, right? There are different ways of answering this question, right? But in every case, right, all of these philosophers are assuming that our starting point, right, is one where the resources are already distributed equally. And then the question is just how do we go from here? And so Mills points out that, but that's not the world. We don't live in a world where things started off distributed equally and that we have these inequalities now because of fairness, right? We live in a world where some people have, a very small number of people have the vast majority of the resources for reasons that are not justified, right? And we can look historically at all of these horrific things that people generally of European descent have done, right? The evils of colonialism, right? That explain these disparities in resources, right? And again, no one who knows anything about this history would dare try to defend it as okay, right? But then somehow we forget all of that when we're asking these questions about, you know, what people deserve, right? And so Charles really, really pushed against this. And he said, no, like when we do that, or that, you know, again, that benefits the people who have the power now, right? The people who are white, male, wealthy, Western, right? But those aren't the people that maybe we should be most concerned about from the point of view of justice. Maybe we should be concerned about marginalized people, right? And so what Charles really started to try to do is really kind of focus, make these questions about marginality kind of central to our political discussions. And so what that looks like in the context of this massive research program that I'd embarked on using Kant for feminist purposes, right, was to sort of step back and ask myself, wait a minute, I've been sure, why have I been so certain that Kant has all this stuff to teach feminism, but feminists don't have anything to teach Kant or Kantians, right? Well, it's because I was doing ideal theory. Right. But if you step outside that, I was already trying to do, right? So it was like once the penny sort of dropped for me, and it was in conversations with Charles, and I realized, okay, so in a part, it was actually he was interpreting my work as doing this in a way that I hadn't realized I was doing it, right? And so what that does, if you use feminism and oppression theory to understand Kantianism, right, it means that the way you use Kant is very different. Right, and so that's there's a sense in which I was already kind of doing it, but there's a sense in which since I've had that shift, I've been a lot more critical of Kant and of the social contract tradition in general. Right, I've sort of allowed myself to start asking questions like, is Kant really right that the thing about us that's most morally significant is our rationality, this ability that we have to set and pursue ends according to reason? Because again, notice the ideally rational person is gendered male, right? We think of men as sort of being intellectual and rational, mathematical, logical in ways that women aren't. Women are emotional, right? So notice what this has done historically. Is this stuff seeping into the way I'm theorizing in ways I haven't noticed? And at this point, I'm sort of at this position with my own work and looking back on it historically and sort of thinking that I need to sort of be in a position of like, maybe the jury's out, right? I think I just need to take more seriously these questions that are really critical of Kant's framing of what's important and why, and again, see what's left. This is one of the fun things about being able to be an academic for a very long time, is it's watching your views change, right? And being willing to change your view, being willing to look back and be like, that was a bad argument, I don't like that, like, and to criticize yourself, you know, as a philosopher, it's I think a lot of people are afraid of it, but for me it's the most fun, I love it.
I mean, it also reflects like personal development. So I don't think there's anything wrong with admitting you've been wrong in the past because you just didn't know things. I feel like the whole idea of academia is to find things out. So if we had known all of them before, nobody would have made mistakes, but also there would be no point in doing the whole thing.
That's exactly right.
And also society changes and how people view topics. They're also like, you are changed by what happens in your society. Have your views change and then change what you have said before. But yeah, go on.
Yep, that's exactly right. I remember sort of just after I'd finished my PhD, having this sort of moment of panic, because I'm like, oh, I can't be done grad school. I don't know everything. Right? Having this sense that like, oh no, I can't, like, what do you mean? Now I'm a I have to go off on my own and I have a job, and like, no, I need more school. And I had a mentor sit me down and said, like, no one expects you to know everything, right? That's like all graduate school teaches you is how to teach yourself, right? That's what you have at the end of it is the ability to teach yourself the answers to these questions. And I think that's right.
So you just talked about like that you basically viewed feminism from a Kantian perspective. And now basically you look at how the world actually is and how feminism works and try to look through that lens at Kant. Could you give some examples of how that changed how you look at specific things?
Sure. One of the things it's done is it's, again, so if you look at some of my early work, right, I just say, I mean, I'm taking up the question of Kant's misogyny, right? Because Kant says some really horrific things about women. I would just say, no, don't worry. Like that stuff was just in his peripheral works. It wasn't because it's true that Kant actually doesn't tend to talk much about women at all in the works considered to be central, right? So the Critique of Pure Reason, all that stuff, right? The Metaphysics of Morals, the Groundwork. Kant doesn't tend to talk about women much at all, right? That's sort of central stuff, right? The stuff he talks about it tends to be in things like his lectures on ethics, right? Which were actually just like the lecture notes that his students took during his lectures, right? Talks about a lot of this more practical stuff about, you know, the differences between the sexes a lot in those lectures. In his anthropology and his religion, right? These sort of works that a lot of philosophers consider to be kind of like secondary or peripheral, right? But in the central stuff, it doesn't really show up at all. And so when I started off, I said, look, we can just excise that stuff because it doesn't actually show up in the stuff that's important, right? Whereas now I sort of think, notice what I'm doing in assuming that certain work was important and certain work, like Kant himself didn't say that. Kant never said, yes, this is the stuff that matters and this is the stuff that doesn't matter, right? Like for him, it was just his work, right? But of course, you know, interpreters prioritize certain texts over others because it serves their interpretive purposes. Right. And so what I really stopped doing is just buying into that, right? Buying into the thought that just because something Kant says something in his religion or his observations on the beautiful and sublime, right? That those things really, you know, do ramify and Kant meant them, he wrote them, right? And so we can take it seriously, right? And so again, so what this means is that it involves really sort of then asking ourselves, how do we solve this puzzle, right? Where Kant says really, really terribly sexist things. He says terribly misogynistic things. The stuff he says about queer people, oh my God, no, right? Terrible, right? How do we make sense of that? How do we make that coherent with the stuff he says in other works where he gives us this gorgeous, sophisticated, egalitarian account, right? Where every human being is equal, right? And they're equal because we have this shared capacity for reason, right? So Kant contradicts himself. Right. And so it's an interpretive puzzle. How do we make sense of this interpretive puzzle? Right. We can just, you know, like conveniently write off all the stuff that doesn't fit with egalitarianism and say, no, the real Kant is the egalitarian stuff. Right. Or we can say, you know what, like maybe that stuff infects the egalitarianism. Maybe this isn't as egalitarian as we've interpreted it as being. Right. Maybe there's a problem with this theory because he said this stuff. And again, I'm not saying there must be a problem. I'm actually like, I'm sincerely raising the question, right? These are the questions that I find most philosophically interesting these days. Let's sit down and figure it out. Let's think about how these oppressive biases might ramify through the theory. Maybe they don't, right? Or maybe there are ways of like making sense, like using the central ideas of Kant that I find so beautiful, in ways that aren't infected by this. But I think the jury's out, right? Like talk to me in 10 years. I'll get back to you.
I think this is also very interesting because historically that is done a lot, that you basically just separate other humans from yourself in a way that makes your actions towards them okay. So in the Nazi government, for example, disabled people or Jews, the most commonly known ones are Jews, but also queer people were just seen as not worthy, basically. Mm-hmm. Yes, and therefore it was okay to treat them like this. So there was this separation done where people purposefully said, because people do this or are this. Therefore, they are not worthy. And therefore, I feel like you can kind of omit this cognitive dissonance where you're like, this would not be okay. But if I don't look at this person as a human, I can kind of, yeah. I think this has been done a lot, like, historically.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's happening a lot here in America now, right, in the context of immigration, right? So I think that, you notice that in the rhetoric of the new administration is that, like, there's a lot of dehumanizing rhetoric, right? Leaving aside that, you know, we actually now have Nazi salutes coming from these people, right? Right, but just in the rhetoric itself, it is a rhetoric of dehumanization, right? And I think that's key, right, if you're going to start depriving people of their rights.
Yeah. I think that's just also something that, well, to a certain degree, we also notice happening in Germany at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Where I also feel like this dissonance between people who say, well, at the one hand, we want that, well, they pray that, or they say that they want the best for majority, but then are so strongly against certain groups of people that, well, there needs to be disconnect between human and those groups. Mm-hmm. And just when you talked about the soul dissonance in Kant's theories, I kind of remembered having a discussion in school still where we talked about if Kant viewed women as humans or not. Yeah. And I can't remember which conclusion we came to, but I just remembered that we had like one whole session where we just discussed, are women humans according to Kant or not?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a fascinating question, right? Because on the one hand, he says a bunch of things that make it explicitly clear that he thinks women are subhumans, right? In a certain sense, right? So the one place in these central works that happens in the Metaphysics of Morals where he actually talks about women is in his Doctrine of Right. And he's talking about it in the context of this this category of people he calls passive citizens, right? So he's trying to make sense of the question of who's allowed to vote, who's allowed to sort of like, you know, structure, right? So it's in this larger discussion of democracy, right? And of voting, right? And he's got this question about like, well, is there like, why is it okay that children aren't allowed to vote, right? Why is that not respecting them, right? And he says, no, it's okay because children are passive citizens, right? Because they're under the care and protection of an active citizen, right? And so that's how we sort of work. We respect their rights, not by giving them, you know, voting access directly, but through active citizenship, but through passive citizenship. And that, you know, that makes sense when it comes to children, right? And but the thing is, he's got other people in this category, right? So he has a bunch of sort of like people like blacksmiths who basically, because I guess there were sort of like itinerant blacksmiths who like didn't necessarily own their own stuff, but they sort of like went from place to place versus blacksmiths who had their own shop, right? So basically, I think, the difference between like an apprentice versus like someone who actually, you know, was a professional in the trade, right? And so the thought is like apprentices don't have the full rights of the professionals, but that's okay because they're actually taken care of by the professionals, right? Again, this might make sense, right? And then he puts women in this category. Right. The reason, because of course, women didn't have the right to vote at this point. The reason women don't have the right to vote is because they're cared for by their husbands and fathers, these active citizens. Right. And Kant says explicitly, like, well, the reason why the very idea of passive citizenship is justifiable is because people who are in this category of passive citizen are not blocked from working their way up to active citizenship. Right. So children grow up. And become active citizens. So that's why when they're passive citizens, it's okay, right? Apprentices can become professionals. And that's why this category is justifiable, right? But so now Kant, right, this fantastically brilliant genius of a man doesn't seem to have noticed that there's no way for women to work their way up to become men, right? Like, what's going on with that, right? So yeah, like, does Kant consider women to be fully human? Like, unclear given this, right? But then other places, right, he's very, very clear, right? Like, your rationality isn't the same thing as your intelligence, right? So it's like, It really is just this very, like for Kant, this, that this, you know, your humanity is this really pretty bare ability that we have to set and pursue ends according to reason, right? To ask ourselves what we want, to ask ourselves how to get it, and to reflect on whether we should want it and whether we should get it in this way, right? And so it's sort of like it's like a threshold capacity. Once you have this capacity, you're a human, right? You have all of the dignity of a moral person, and we're very constrained in how we could treat you morally speaking, right? And so it's pretty clear that Kant thinks women have that, right? And so it's not, so in that sense, yeah, Kant obviously thinks women are human, right? So again, like there's conflicting evidence in the corpus itself about whether Kant thinks women are fully human, right? Yeah. Because again, historically, right, we have, and certainly in Kant's day, people thought that women were less rational than men, right? Women are emotional, right? So it doesn't, then does this mean that women are less human than men, right? Again, an interpretation could be made, right? I suspect this is what you were arguing about back in school.
Possibly. Like, really, I can't remember. I just remember the question and then sitting in the classroom, but I can't remember anything of the argument.
Probably, maybe your blood was boiling, being like, really, we're taking seriously the possibility that people like me are human? Cool.
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah. Like, this is a fun intellectual exercise.
I'm just constantly thinking about if there's any good way of bringing current politics into the end, just because I feel like right now it's quite pressing.
I mean, I think there's some general things I can speak to. Like, I've been referring to it as the horrors, like just sort of wave my, because there's so many terrible things happening so quickly, right? We're just being overwhelmed, right? And again, that's the strategy. It's the sort of shock and awe strategy, and it's terrifying, right? If anyone with any kind of knowledge of history of the last 100 years, right, knows the depths to which we've sunk, shown ourselves capable of sinking, right? You know, the horrors of the Holocaust, right? And it's been really interesting, I think, for a lot of people who aren't German to sort of watch Germany's response to that, right? To sort of like watch the really, really sincere reckoning that so many German people had for generations after the Second World War. And as you know, as a moral and political philosopher, right? Like that ability and willingness to do that, right? As you know, like imperfect and as partial as it might have been, was just sort of really seen as something, an incredible achievement, right? And like an ability for like a collective to take collective responsibility for something and to insist that it never happen again, right? And to learn from one's mistakes, right? It's a marker of maturity, right? It's, you know, like just as, you know, like a child is, we think a child is mature, right? When he or she could take responsibility for her actions, learn from them, right? And so too, even as adults, right? We're always sort of trying to do that, learn from our mistakes, own up to our mistakes, you know, admit when we've done something wrong and try to do better, right? And so I think that like a lot of the world really saw Germany's reckoning as an example of that and a really admirable example of that. And of course, what's so terrifying now is to sort of see what's happening as this collective backsliding, right? And we're so much more interconnected globally now than we were 50 or 60 years ago, right? And so these populist uprisings, right? These right-wing uprisings, right? They feed on each other, right? And so what happens here in America, right? Feeding these voices has global impact. And I am legitimately terrified about where things are going. I'm terrified as a woman. I'm terrified as a mother. I'm terrified as a queer person. My partner is trans. And we don't know whether their passport is valid right now. It's terrifying, right? And it's terrifying to think about how bad things are going to get. And I think it's all new. It's all happening really quickly. And I think we're all scrambling to figure out what to do, right? It's really striking to me that there haven't been a lot of protests, right? There hasn't been a lot of like public resistance the way you saw in 2016. And I don't even just personally, right? Like I find myself sort of like turtling into a shell, right? Where I just 2 days ago deactivated all of my social media and I've basically stopped reading the news for more than about 10 minutes a day because it's just overwhelming. I can't, right? because it feels like a survival strategy, right? But no, of course, like, I can't let myself sit here in my privilege for too long, right? I need to figure out how to fight back. But I don't know what it is yet. And I think that a lot of people are in my shoes, right? Where we're biding our time, we're conserving our energy, right? And we're figuring out how and where and when we're going to resist this, because I think things are going to get really bad.
To give a little bit of context for when this episode comes out, Trump has been back in the White House for 3 days now.
3 days, yeah.
So it's the 24th of January today.
Yes, yeah. Just to give a little bit of context, because I assume there will be some weeks until this episode comes out, and currently, every time you look at the news, Trump has signed something new. And also in Germany, elections are happening in a month. And in Germany, a very right-wing party is also currently gaining a lot of attention and a lot of support. So it's not only in the US, it's also very much in Germany. And if you look at some other European countries like the Netherlands, their last votes were last year, I think. Also the right party won, so...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't know, I think that as progressives, as people who have an understanding of history, right, you know, we're going to be navigating these questions of how do we take care of ourselves, how do we take care of our loved ones, and when is the point that we start making sacrifices, right? Being willing to make sacrifices for the general good, right? These sort of, I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, right, it was a sort of like hypothetical question that, you know, you would ask yourself, like, what would I have done in Nazi Germany, right? And that question is not going to be hypothetical anymore, right? And it's, yeah, so I think we're there, and we're going to find out what kind of people we are collectively and individually.
Okay.
That was dark. Sorry.
No, this has been how I've been feeling the past few days. Every time I look at my phone, every time I look at social media, at the news, it's just, more horrible things, basically. Like, I don't even...
It just feels like a downward spiral that's just going faster and faster.
And no one knows where the bottom is.
Yeah. Quite far down, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm not sure we want to find out how far down it is, to be very honest. I'm not sure I want to explore that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have to say it's been pleasant to spend the last hour and a half thinking about something else. Thank you for letting me distract myself with content.
Okay. I would do wrap up now.
Yes. I've just been thinking if there's any way to, bring spirits back to a slightly brighter tone, but I think it's really hard at the moment. I don't like ending in a depressive mood, but also it wouldn't feel right to try to improve the mood at the moment, just because it's...
So there's something that I think that I can point to that can both accommodate the gravity of the current situation, but maybe not feed despair, which is what we want to avoid, right? Because despair leads to inaction. And it's the work of an American comedian named Alok, A-L-O-K. They're all over Instagram. I recommend going finding them there. And so they're a trans comedian, non-binary. And they talk about, among other things, they talk about the importance of joy as a strategy of resistance, right? So they say, you know, as a visibly queer, trans, non-binary person, right, they get a lot of hate mail. They get a lot of death threats. They're a public, their public persona. And so they get a lot of people who are so offended by their existence, right, that they feel compelled to, reach out with vitriol, right? And they said that for a long time, this really sort of got to them, right? Like, it's just hard to kind of weather that kind of abuse, right? But then at some point they thought, wait a minute, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to break me down, right? They're trying to prevent me from having a good life, right? So my refusal to do that, right? I guess we could think about it as a sort of, you know, duty to the self resistance, right? My refusal to do that is a form of resistance, right? So they say that we need to think about queer joy, queer humor, right? And again, we can generalize that out from, you know, queer experiences to the experiences of women, racialized people, anything else, or even just, you know, people opposed to this, the downward spiral, right? They want to make us miserable, right? And so by refusing to let them, right, by finding solidarity, by finding meaning in collective action, right, by like, we're resisting, right? We're not letting them get us down. And that is a form of resistance. Again, it can't be the only one, right? We are going to have to, like, engage in a lot of activism out in the world, right? But, you know, letting ourselves, you know, laugh, you know, do things we love, right? It's not just shallow, commodified self-care. It really can be a form of resistance, right? Because it's because we need our strength for what's coming.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I like that.
That's all I got. Okay.
Okay. If somebody has listened to today's episode, what would be, like, the big things to take away in one or two sentences?
We were all over the place. I'm not sure.
Okay. What are the things which now come to your mind, which stuck out, where you're like, okay, maybe this is a good takeaway?
Sure. So I think, for me, maybe the conversation we were having about non-ideal theory, right? This ability to kind of, like, do theoretical philosophical work about politics, about ethics, right? While recognizing the incredibly imperfect world that we're actually in. For me, I think this is the most exciting thing that a philosopher can do, right? So I use the abstract theoretical resources of the canon of philosophy to really think seriously about where we are and how to go somewhere else. And for me, I think that's one of the things that I'm grateful for having a career and, you know, training that lets me do that.
Okay. And if you had to weave cognition into what we've talked about today, what would you think, like, how does cognition fit into that?
So I guess I would interpret cognition as maybe what philosophers would call knowledge, right? Or truth, right? And so for me, I think of Kant's description of these rational capacities that we have as a form of cognition, right? It's a way of understanding the world and a way of making sense of normativity, right? Or the question of what we should do using these particular thought processes. So I think that's how I would weave cognition into all of this. It's a kind of moral knowledge that we're talking about.
Okay, then if nobody else has any more things that should be mentioned, thank you so much for talking to us today. It was a very pleasant conversation.
I agree. I had a great time. Thank you. You have excellent questions. And I mean it. It was refreshing to have a break from thinking about the outside world for a minute. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
Of course, of course.
You've listened to Collider Science, Conversations on Cognitive Science, hosted by Elisa Palmer, Sönke Löw and Sophie Kühne. Produced by Clara Kühne, Imogen Hüsing, Elisa Palmer, Sönke Löw and Sophie Kühne. Produced in collaboration with the Cognitive Science Student Journal. The music was produced by Jan-Lukas Schröder. The logo was designed by Annika Richter. Thank you for listening and joining us on our journey through Conversations on Cognitive Science. This podcast is not sponsored and does not give us any financial profit. If you wish to support us, the most effective way is to do so by leaving us an up to 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and following us on Instagram. You can reach out to us via mail, comment on YouTube, or message us on Instagram. We are always happy to hear your feedback. Thank you again for listening to us and for your interest in science. If you have any questions regarding this episode or any of our other episodes, feel free to reach out. You can reach out to us via Instagram by sending us a direct message at kaleidoscience_pod or write us an email at kaleidopod@us.de. You can find both links to our Instagram and also the email address in our show notes. We do read all your comments and will also reply to you as soon as we can.